Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
This is where we take a look at some key sources, try to cut through the noise, and give you the insights you really need.
Yeah, get right to the core of it.
And you can always learn more about our work. We do strategic advisory, education, public engagement on things like cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy. It's all at thesecuritynexus.net.
Our whole mission is really to inform, educate, and, you know, empower, whether you're deep in the field or just really curious.
Exactly. So today, we're diving into something pretty critical.
Mm-hmm.
How cyber attacks are impacting way more than just tech systems. We're looking at the effects on people, on politics, and maybe most fundamentally, freedom of expression.
Yeah, going beyond just the technical bits. It's about the human side, the political side.
And we've got some really solid sources to help us unpack this.
We do. We've been digging into an article by Joe Burton from the Baltic Journal of European Studies. It looks right at cyber attacks and freedom of expression. Then there's a piece on understanding and countering cyber coercion, which is fascinating. And a paper on using personalized deceptive signaling for cyber defense. Lots of authors on that one. Edward A. Cranford, Cleotilde Gonzalez, Palvi Agarwal, Sarah Cooney, Mylan Tambe, and Christian Libier.
Wow, quite a team.
Yeah. And finally, the latest National Cyber Threat Assessment for 2025-2026 from CSE Canada gives a really current picture.
Okay, great. So our mission today.
Yeah.
Connect the dots between these, help you get a handle on the nuances, you know, how cyber ops are used for influence, the challenges they pose, and how we're starting to think about defense.
Let's do it. So when most people hear cyber attack,
yeah,
they think technical stuff, right? Systems down, data stolen, websites defaced, that kind of thing. That's the traditional view.
Right. Digital vandalism or maybe espionage, yeah. Purely technical.
Exactly. But what these sources really hammer home is that view is, well, getting too narrow. Cyber operations are increasingly used not just for damage, but to influence behavior. Ah, okay. So shifting from breaking things to making people do things or maybe not do things.
Precisely. That brings in these big strategic ideas like coercion, using threats to change behavior.
Like compel someone to act or dissuade them from acting. Stuff from shelling.
Exactly that. Drawing on those classic strategic thinkers, the idea is leveraging the potential harm from cyber capabilities as pressure.
So, like, don't pursue that policy or your banks might go offline, that kind of threat.
That's the shape of it. One view in the sources frames this as basically intentional bullying or intimidation, just on a state or group level, designed to affect what people or groups or even whole countries decide to do
mm-hmm.
or not do.
But hold on, calling it coercion, it feels different. Cyber attacks aren't like, you know, mobilizing troops. It's not physical force in the same way.
That's a really key point of debate in the sources.
Okay.
Cyber ops aren't kinetic. They don't blow things up directly. And you're right, achieving those classic coercion elements, a clear threat, making it credible, reassuring the target that compliance stops the pain that's super murky online because it's hard to know who's doing it.
Exactly. Attribution's tough. Motives can be hidden. So some argue it's less pure coercion and more like cyber swaggering. Projecting power, intimidating, but maybe without a clear, achievable demand attached.
Okay, swaggering, intimidation. This is where it connects directly to freedom of expression, right?
Okay.
If the goal is influence and fear.
Bingo. Joe Burton's article makes this link crystal clear because cyber attacks can target and manipulate the information environment itself.
The space where we talk and share ideas.
Right. They become tools to stifle freedom of expression. It's not just about shutting one person up. It's about warping the whole conversation space.
How does that actually work? What are the ways these attacks hit free expression?
The sources basically lay out three main pathways. First, simple intimidation and bullying, creating fear.
How so?
Attackers leak personal info, they harass people online, they send threats, it makes people scared to speak out. Think about Cyberberku leaking data on Ukrainian military folks loyal to Kyiv, or online attacks timed with the Euromaidan protests, trying to limit how protesters could share information. And then there's the Myret Faretz website, publishing personal details, sometimes linked to, well, alleged assassinations. That's extreme intimidation. A massive human rights issue tied directly to silencing expression through fear.
Chilling. Okay, so direct fear is one way. What's the second?
Undermining elections. Attacks that aim to corrupt the process, disrupt voting, or just change how people perceive the election's legitimacy.
Interfering with democracy itself.
Exactly. which is a core part of expressing your political will. A key example is the attack on Ukraine's Central Electoral Committee website back in May 2014.
What happened there?
Well, the attack blocked information flow. It made people doubt the process, and it even displayed fake results on the official site for a while. Russian TV reported those fake results.
Did it change the outcome?
Luckily, no. They had backups. But the intent was clear. Undermine credibility, influence how people saw the election. One source even suggests that might have been a dry run for tactics used later, like in the 2016 U.S. election.
A pest case.
Could be. And the point is, if you mess with elections like that, you're messing with the electorate's freedom of choice. They can't evaluate information fairly, or they don't even know they're being manipulated.
Okay, fear, election meddling. What's the third mechanism?
This one's about virtual infiltration or virtual occupation, basically flooding the zone.
Flooding it with what?
With disinformation, propaganda, noise, drowning out the accurate information people need to form their own political views without malicious interference.
So polluting the well.
That's a good way to put it. In the cyber context, the sources argue access to uncorrupted information becomes part of freedom of expression itself.
If you can't get reliable facts, you can't really express an informed opinion freely.
Precisely. Examples include things like Russian state-sponsored polluted information campaigns in Crimea, hacking billboards to show scary messages, using malware to push pro-Russia videos.
I remember reading about the Arab Spring, too, how governments push back online.
Yeah, another case. Protesters used social media, and authoritarian regimes countered with floods of false narratives and online intimidation. It's weaponizing the attention economy, using disinformation, hate speech, online harassment, not just to be nasty, but strategically to limit free expression by making the online space toxic or untrustworthy.
And that undermines democratic debate.
Totally. The sources link it back to ideas of deliberative democracy needing reasoned info exchange, citing John Rawls even. Free information is tied to the right to participate.
Yeah, we've definitely seen some huge examples play out globally.
Oh, absolutely. The Sony hack in 2014 is a big one. Remember the fallout, canceling a movie release? President Obama actually called it a serious blow to freedom of expression.
I do remember that.
And then, of course, the 2016 Russian interference in the U.S. election. Infiltrating DNC servers, the Podesta spear phishing, dumping info via WikiLeaks, clear cyber ops aimed at manipulating the info environment and influencing a democratic outcome.
And even earlier examples.
Yeah, the attacks on Estonia in 2007 and Georgia in 2008. They had strong informational components, too, trying to infiltrate or occupy that information space. Samuel Hitaja called it informational violence.
What about something like NotPetya in 2017? That felt like pure destruction.
Yeah.
Wiped systems globally.
NotPetya's interesting. Attributed by Western Intel in Ukraine to Russian military intelligence, GRU. It caused massive damage, no question.
So was it just about damage?
Well, theories vary. Maybe damage was the goal. Maybe it was cover for other intrusions. Or maybe it was a political signal like don't invest in Ukraine. While maybe not directly aimed at silencing speech in that moment, one source sees it as part of a wider pattern.
A pattern of
intimidation. Using cyber capabilities to shape the political landscape through non-military means, which indirectly definitely impacts the environment for free expression and political discourse.
Okay, so these attacks are complex, aiming for influence, hitting fundamental rights. But it can't be easy for the attackers either, right? What challenges do they face?
Good point. The sources dig into several big hurdles for attackers, too. Attribution is huge.
Figuring out who did it.
Right. It's really hard. Attackers use proxies, false flags. They mask their origins. It takes serious forensic work. Intelligence gathering takes time. Sophisticated deceptions can run for years. Remember the JP Morgan Chase hack? First blamed on Russia, later tracked to a criminal gang.
So quick, certain attribution is rare.
Very rare. Which messes up any response, especially if you want to punish someone. And there's a paradox.
Yeah.
The more you reveal about how you figured it out, the more you risk tipping off your intelligence methods.
Tricky. What else?
Ambiguity. Often, these cyber coercion campaigns, the threats aren't clear. The demands aren't specific. Attribution might be fuzzy. Well, the North Korean-y case, the demand eventually became clear. Pull the movie. But who was behind it was murky at first. Other attacks, like on South Korean banks, had no clear threat or claim attached. And in the Russia-Ukraine context, you have these aggressive cyber groups. Their ties to the government might be deliberately fuzzy. Who is really threatening you? What do they want you to do to make it stop? It's often unclear.
And the nature of cyberspace itself
adds layers of complexity. You have to think about the whole comms environment, not just tech capabilities. Plus, Different countries see cyber differently. Western views versus, say, Russia or China, very different strategic cultures about its use.
Right.
And of course, it's borderless. Which laws apply online? Whose values govern free expression? That's been a challenge since the early days of the internet. Johnson & Post flagged it way back in 96.
Okay, so if attacks are hard to pin down, often ambiguous, how do we defend? How do we deter? Especially when traditional deterrence relies on clear threats and consequences.
That's the million-dollar question. Deterrence in cyber is a massive focus, building on those classic thinkers like Schelling and Nye. You've got deterrence by punishment.
Threatening retaliation.
Yeah. And deterrence by denial.
Making the attack too hard to succeed.
Exactly. And punishment, as you said, is really tough in cyber because of the attribution problem. How do you punish effectively if you're not sure who did it or what they even care about losing?
Seems almost impossible sometimes.
The sources acknowledge those huge difficulties. Slow attribution, uncertain adversaries, unknown risk calculus. But, they argue, deterrence by punishment still has to be part of the picture, maybe anchored by other capabilities.
Like what?
Like broader military power. The idea that cyber is just one rung on an escalation ladder. A 2013 Defense Science Board report, citing General Cartwright, basically suggested nuclear weapons might still be the ultimate backstop, anchoring the whole deterrence framework. It signals that a cyber attack could trigger responses beyond cyberspace.
Okay, so punishment is tricky but still there.
Yeah.
What about denial? Making yourself a harder target.
That's seen as really crucial, maybe more achievable day-to-day in cyber. Denial is all about increasing the attacker's work factor, making it cost them more time, more resources, more effort than they want to spend.
Raising the bar for them.
Exactly. Basic stuff like hardening systems, controlling access better, good surveillance to spot intrusions early, but also more active defenses, not just firewalls. Bruce Schneier talks about this a lot. Make the attack too expensive, too uncertain, or take too long.
Makes sense. But against really sophisticated attackers, state-level actors, criminals with resources, it feels like a constant race just to keep up defenses. How do defenders get an edge?
This is where that paper by Cranford and his colleagues gets really interesting. They look at using cognitive models and deceptive signaling for active defense.
Deceptive signaling? You mean like actively tricking the attacker?
That's the idea. Instead of just building walls, strategically mislead the attacker to gain an advantage, especially if you can't protect everything equally.
How do they model that?
They used simulations, specifically something called an insider attack game, to model how a human attacker might behave. And they used cognitive models, specifically instance-based learning, or IBL, to try and predict that behavior.
IBL. How does that work, simply?
Basically, the model learns from past experiences. It predicts what an attacker might do based on how recent, how frequent, and how similar past situations were. Then they use other techniques, model tracing, knowledge tracing, to tune that model to predict how a specific individual attacker might decide things.
So you can tailor the deception.
That's the goal. Personalized signaling. Show that attacker misleading information designed to exploit their likely biases or decision patterns based on how the model thinks they think.
Huh. So the defense learns the attacker's habits and uses that to feed them bad info, making them less likely to hit the real targets.
That's the concept. Their simulations suggested personalized signaling could reduce the chances of a successful attack compared to non-personalized deception. It's maybe a modest effect in the sim, but it's a fascinating direction defense as not just blocking, but actively influencing the attacker's choices using behavioral insights.
Very cool. Okay, let's pivot now. Bring it closer to home with the CSE Canada report.
Mm-hmm.
What's the big picture from their latest assessment of the threat landscape?
The National Cyber Threat Assessment paints a pretty stark picture. Canada's facing an expanding and increasingly complex cyber threat landscape. It's coming from states, it's coming from criminals, and it's persistent, affecting almost every sector.
Which state actors are the biggest concerns for Canada right now?
The People's Republic of China, the PRC, is singled out as the most sophisticated and active state threat. Their goals, espionage, stealing intellectual property, malign influence campaigns, and even transnational repression.
To serve their own political and economic goals.
Right. They target all levels of Canadian government, public officials, especially anyone critical of the CCP. And crucially, Canada's private sector are innovation hubs, trying to get a competitive edge or accelerate their own tech development. The report says this activity ramps up when relations are tense and likely will keep increasing as economic competition grows.
And that transnational repression piece.
Mm.
using cyber tools for that. That links back to our earlier points.
Absolutely. The report says the PRC very likely supports cyber actions targeting groups they see as threats, the so-called five poisons, things like tracking Canadian MPs, email operations against groups critical of the CCP, like members of the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. It's using cyber to try and silence dissent, even abroad.
What about Russia?
Russia's cyber program is seen as actively working to confront and destabilize Canada and our allies. Because we're in NATO, support Ukraine, have an Arctic presence, Canada's a valuable espionage target, they might use supply chain compromises to get in.
And non-state actors linked to Russia.
Yeah, the report highlights those too. Pro-Russia groups, likely with government ties, conducting disruptive attacks like DDoS against Canada, often trying to sway our foreign policy.
Okay. The report also mentions Iran, North Korea, India as significant state actors globally. But the main focus for Canada seems to be PRC and Russia.
That's right. Those two get the most detailed treatment regarding specific impacts on Canada in the assessment.
Beyond states, what about cybercrime? That affects everyone.
Huge issue. Cybercrime is described as persistent, widespread, incredibly disruptive, and mostly about money. A key driver is this whole interconnected online ecosystem, cybercrime as a service, or CARES.
CARES, like crime tools for rent.
Pretty much. It drastically lowers the barrier to entry. Lets less skilled criminals launch sophisticated attacks. There are whole marketplaces, forums, chat groups for selling stolen data, buying malware, sharing tips.
What are Canadians running into most often?
Fraud and scams are still the most common. Phishing, spear phishing, they have a big financial impact. And the report specifically calls out AI, especially large language models.
Making scams better.
Making them much more effective. AI helps create super personalized, grammatically perfect phishing emails. We're also seeing phishing as a service kits making it easier. And deepfakes are emerging for impersonation attempts. More accessible, more convincing.
And ransomware. Still a major headache.
A huge one. Growing and evolving. Ransomware incidents actually went up in Canada in 2023 after a bit of a dip in 2022, maybe due to law enforcement pressure or disruptions from the Ukraine conflict initially. It's hitting critical infrastructure hard.
How are ransomware gangs changing tactics?
They're getting much more aggressive with extortion. It's not just encrypting files anymore. Now they leak data on public sites with countdown timers. They call victims clients or employees. They publicly shame companies. They even use things like SEC reporting rules in the U.S. to pressure victims into paying.
Doubling down on the pressure.
Exactly. Plus more complex techniques to hide their tracks. And the whole ransomware as a service model makes these groups really flexible and resilient, even when some get taken down.
And those supply chain attacks.
Yeah.
Like Movia.
Devastating. The report really emphasizes the impact of attacks like the CL0P group exploiting Moviet and Go Anywhere in 2023. Thousands of organizations hit, millions of people affected worldwide. Big ransom payouts. These attacks on the digital supply chain are just too profitable to stop, so we'll likely see more. Countering it needs huge collaboration, government, industry, law enforcement, public awareness.
Okay, looking ahead now, what are the really big trends the CSE report sees shaping the threat landscape?
Several key ones stand out. First, AI amplifying everything.
We just talked about that with phishing.
Right. It's lowering barriers for attackers, boosting the quality, scale, precision of attacks across the board. Generative AI helps create malicious content, analyze data, automate steps. It's turbocharging social engineering, like we said, and also foreign online influence campaigns think AI-generated disinformation, fake bot accounts, and you can bet well-resourced states are using AI to crunch the massive amounts of data they collect through espionage.
So AI makes existing threats worse, faster, smarter.
That's the main thrust. Second trend, evolving tradecraft to beat better defenses.
How so?
Attackers are targeting edge devices, more routers, firewalls, VPNs, because organizations often have less visibility there. Exploiting VPN flaws was a big tactic by state actors hitting government and critical infrastructure early in 2024. And they're still jumping on publicly known vulnerabilities, CVEs, super fast after disclosure, often before patches get rolled out.
What about hacktivists? Politically motivated groups?
That's trend number three. Geopolitically inspired non-state actors. Conflicts fuel disruptive hacktivism, DDoS, website defacements, data leaks. Sometimes they hit critical infrastructure, which is risky. These groups pop up, shift alliances, motivations are mixed patriotism, ideologies, sometimes profit. Their links to states can be murky, but sometimes aligned, very dynamic and unpredictable.
And the fact that so much relies on a few big companies
leads to the fourth trend. Dominant service providers are huge targets. Think major cloud providers, Amazon, Microsoft, Google. They're magnets for attacks trying to steal data or bypass security. A compromise there is a digital choke point, causing cascading effects for everyone who relies on them. We saw this with Microsoft Exchange compromises linked to China and Russia, and an Azure DDoS outage in 2024.
Finally, what about services used by both civilians and military?
Trend 5. Dual-use commercial services are in the crosshairs. Things like commercial satellite communications. Governments and militaries use them, but so do civilians. Adversaries have shown they're willing and able to disrupt these during conflicts, which spills over and impacts civilian users globally. The Russian operations against commercial SATCOM used by Ukraine is a prime example.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot. We've covered coercion theory, freedom of expression impacts, ransomware tactics, AI amplifiers. So let's bring it all together. Why does all this matter to you, the listener?
Because it's not abstract. It's not just tech issues or distant politics. Cyber attacks aiming to influence you, attacks on elections, ransomware hitting your local hospital or power company, compromises of the cloud services you use every single day.
They hit home.
They hit home directly. They affect the information you get, whether you can trust institutions, the safety of your personal data, the basic services you count on.
It really shows how deeply tangled the digital world is with our physical lives, our political lives now.
It really is. And understanding this shifting landscape, who the actors are, what they want, how they operate, what the impacts could be, it isn't just for the experts anymore. It's actually crucial for building resilience together.
Yeah.
It starts with each of us being aware.
Absolutely. Staying informed is definitely key. This deep dive has given us a ton to think about the sheer complexity of these threats.
And it's a landscape that's just going to keep changing fast, driven by tech, driven by global events.
Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive. Thanks so much for joining us as we wrestled with these really important issues.
Yeah, hope this conversation helped inform, educate, maybe empower you a bit with some clear insights into the strategic security world.
And remember, you can find out more about the Security Nexus, our work on cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, through advisory, education, public engagement. Just visit thesecuritynexus.net.
And maybe one last thought to leave you with, kind of pulling it all together.
Mm-hmm.
In this era where the very basis of free expression, you know, access to reliable information is constantly under attack online, how do we as individuals, as a society, build up the critical thinking skills, the digital literacy we need? How do we protect our own judgment and keep public discourse healthy when it's being deliberately polluted? That puts a lot more responsibility on each of us, doesn't it?